Hello world, welcome back to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's with your hosts, myself, Brian Baglow, and the comfortably homebound Peggy Anseltz. Hello Peggy, it's lovely to see you back at your desk.
I love my desk now, Brian. I was just thinking that on the weekend. It was like, oh, I love it. Deep work, catching up on things, finding amazing guests, and planning out what I'm going to do next with our guest, by the way. You know, it's like this thing where I can actually get into my work. So yes, that's the best way to describe me now. Mellow would be another way to put it.
It's nice to see you. It seems like such a long time since we've been, you know, getting through the podcast, seeing each other every other day or every few days. So I'm delighted. Welcome back. And it's great to be here. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. We have another fabulous show for you this episode. Peggy, who did you get lined up? Who have you found? And how awesome is it going to be?
It's super awesome. For me personally, also a highlight. But I have to say, I thought I'd tie it back in with what we're doing. So, you know, we are getting ready for our big headline shows. We've got Dubai right around the corner. And I thought, okay, we've got big headline shows. Let's match that with a big headline guest. Because I'm excited to welcome Akin Babayit. He is co-founder and president of Triple Dot Studios, and that's one we've been hearing a lot about, Brian.
We have, haven't we just, Peggy? It's like in a period where it just seems like bad news, misery, and awful things going on across the games world, it's always nice to sort of find a company, find people who are doing incredible things and doing so well. So welcome, Akin. It's lovely to have you here.
You guys are way too kind, and thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be on.
Everyone's more than a title, right? And maybe I'll do it with that, because I was so amazed with that as well. Because yes, we're talking about the business of games, the gaming industry, but we're also talking to people and individuals. And let's start there, maybe, Akin, because you have quite an interesting backstory. Yes, you are at the helm of a great gaming studio, and we will get to that in a moment, but a little bit of an interesting backstory as well, and I have to say humorous.
Yeah, my background is, I guess, atypical and a little bit different. I'm from Turkey originally, but I moved to the United States when I was 16 years old by myself as an exchange student. And I somehow managed to not be kicked out from the United States for the next 16 years. I did my high school there. I went to university. I met my current wife. And I lived in the U.S. for about 16 years. I'm a recovering management consultant. I worked at McKinsey for 2 years, absolutely hated it. And then I did business school for 2 years. And right after business school, I got into the world of technology. So, you know, I studied engineering and I'm, you know, quite technical as a person. So I really felt that that was kind of my calling. And in the last, 12 years or so, I've been in the world of gaming. And the thing I always tell my friends is I'm not a gamer in the very stereotypical sense. I don't have a console at home. I don't play, D&D with my friends, etc. But I am a very hardcore gamer in the true sense of the word. If what we mean by gamer is someone who enjoys casual games. And what really attracted me to the space in the early days was how unique the type of people are in the gaming space. I don't think there's any other industry that brings together people who are so creative, but at the same time, so analytical. I don't think you could find that mix in any other sector. So I fell in love with the people in gaming first, and then I fell in love with the business of gaming second. So I remember in around 2009, when I was in the Bay Area, there's a company called Zynga that had this game called Farmville. And that was my first aha moment, understanding the true potential of gaming and what it could do in terms of reaching new audiences. I read somewhere that there was more tractors sold on Farmville in a single day than there's been ever tractors sold up until that point in the real world. Now it kind of seems like a given, but back then it was kind of super mind-blowing for me. So I started getting more involved, and I worked at Peak Games out of Istanbul for a few months, and I stayed as an advisor to the company. But that was really a very unique success story, both in mobile gaming, but also in Turkey as well. After Peak Games, I went over to Facebook. I was there for close to 5 years, initially looking after the partnership of Facebook with a lot of key gaming companies in Europe. And then I was actually part of the team that started the Audience Network. And then I led the sales team for that in Europe. And then after that, I went over to Activision Blizzard, King, where I was there for about a year. And then we started Triple Dot with my co-founder, Lior, and my other co-founder, Eyal. That's kind of what I do for the day job. And we also, by the way, started another company called Luna Labs. Most people don't realize that we were the founders of Luna Labs as well. Mm-hmm. Then we sold it to Iron Source in 2021. And in addition to that, I also try to invest in super exciting founders and companies around the world, like Dream Games, Spike Games, Bigger Games, as well as many others. That's kind of me. Also, I have two young kids, a 13-year-old girl and a 5-year-old boy, and they take off, you know, any of my remaining time.
I won't belabor the point, but what I found was really cool is you've got, not just are you a great, you know, gaming studio and executive, and we'll get to like what you really do in games, but a little humor that keeps you real. What's this, the stand-up comedian part?
It's funny. I did first stand-up comedy in the U.S. when I was an exchange student, and that was on television in Michigan and some other Midwestern states. But actually, during COVID times, when you know we were really kind of scared in the early stages of COVID, and I used that as a kind of challenge to me. I made a promise saying, you know, I'm gonna try to learn a new skill every year. So every new year, I pick a skill and I go down super deep and I try to get a tutor. And, you know, so first year was learning to play a musical instrument. Second year was learning to play chess. Third year is actually when I did stand-up comedy courses. Basically, as a result of that, I performed on stage in London in about 10 venues, more or less. If you're in London and if you are lucky or unlucky, depending on, you know, what you think, you might run into me one of these days.
That's wonderful. So can we drill down into a couple of those studios that you've mentioned? Because you've mentioned Triple Dot, and you've mentioned Dream Games, Spike Games. Do you have any insight into what made them so interesting? What really stood out for you when you decided to invest in them?
Triple Dot was, company that was started out of a need wanting to really focus on the business and the analytics side of gaming. So initially, when we started, we said, we are not the most creative people in terms of coming up with the next gaming mechanic or something like that. We are really good operators. We understand data-driven product management, we understand digital marketing, we understand user acquisition, we understand monetization, and we felt that there was a need for a company like that to really focus on those aspects of gaming. I think a lot of gaming studios are run by people who are really in love with the craft of gaming. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's what makes gaming such an exciting place to be. But we felt that there was an opening where we would really focus on the execution risk of starting a new company. So anytime you start a new company, I think you have two type of risks. You have a market risk, where you don't know if the market is going to be buying the product that you develop. Because oftentimes people, when they start a new company, they start with a new product and they have to find product market fit. And there's the execution risk. So even if the product or the idea that you have seems to have product market fit, then you have to execute on that. So we started started in areas where we knew there was a market. You know, our first game was a solitaire game and everybody thought we were absolutely crazy for starting with solitaire, because there were thousands of free solitaire apps before us. especially because, of course, Lior's background, my co-founder's background, was in social casino before. People had assumed that we would do another social casino game, or people knew that I was a king, so they thought we would do a match three puzzle game. When we started with an ad-based funded solitaire game, people were absolutely shocked. And the reason we started there was we felt we know there's a huge market for solitaire. Therefore, if we execute better than some of the other players in the market, we would win. We would win market share, and we would, be able to make money and kind of stand on our 2 feet. So we were able to do that. We managed to scale solitaire quite rapidly. And then we had a few titles that we didn't manage to scale to their full capacity. And then we had another title which took us quite a while to perfect, which was Wudoku. Wudoku became our biggest game. And then we had a few other titles. So in total, I think we had about 12, 13 titles. And then we have what we call hits. So we have three games that we're operating at scale. Those are Wudoku, Triple Tile, and Solitaire. That was an overnight success that took 6 years to make. But our kind of, mode of operating has always been, we have been very profitable from the get-go. We raised money, yes, etc., but that was always for another purpose, which is to do more M&A, to be a buyer of other gaming companies that we can then help scale. We were profitable from year one and have grown very rapidly since. So we won the fastest growing company in Europe award by the Financial Times last year. And we have about 400 people working in 6 locations in Triple Dot. And that's who we are.
That's absolutely amazing. And again, it echoes so much of what we hear in the podcast, Peggy, that there's so much more than making a game or, focusing on originality. And to go back to what you said earlier, that you're a real casual gamer, fills my heart with delight, because this whole notion that AAA and the sort of the really high budget console and PC titles are the only real games, I think is just absurd. It's so much of the innovation in games comes from the mobile market, and you don't need to be a hardcore 120, 150 hours, dedicated warrior to be a real gamer. So I'm delighted, and that makes a huge amount of sense. And congratulations on everything you're doing with Triple Dot.
I just want to echo something you said, which is very true. And when you look at the gaming market, everyone knows intuitively, and they've heard that it's bigger than movies and music combined. So people know that. What people don't know is you have a market that's really large. No one really knows the true size of it, right? Let's call it $300 billion, more than half of which is mobile, right? But when you look around, you don't have a no-brainer poster child for mobile gaming. You have a bunch of poster childs for the smaller half, right? You have Activision, Take-Two, EA, and others. You don't really have a poster child for the mobile segment. And I think it's just a sign that there will come a day when that poster child will be there. I have no doubt. And you have lots of incredible companies, Supercell, Playrix, Dream Games, others, and other companies and Playtika, who are absolutely amazing operators, Miniclip, and others. But those are not known in the same vein as the Activisions and EAs of the same world. And I think that will change at some point. And I think that's the opportunity. I'm really excited to be operating in that space.
Part of it is clearly your DNA. You understand the business side of gaming. That's really important here. So you love games, but you also understand the business side. And you also think about the marketability and profitability of a new game. Share your thinking a little bit when you're assessing that, because that is looking at a game and its potential And that's very different from looking at a game when you built it and love it and, you know, and the typical sort of gaming, you know, or indie studio, you know, it's going to be a hit. No, there are signs. What are some of those signs?
I think us not necessarily falling in love with the games we build is part of what makes us strong. Because we always look through a, you know, very objective and analytical and frankly cold lens to the metrics, to the numbers. And those lenses adapt, they change over time. So as I said, we launched about 12 games, 13 games, and three of them are really hits. So I think more instructive maybe is in games that didn't scale, there was always some metrics that were, you know, those are pretty good metrics. That's pretty good metrics, etc. But in the ones that made it, there were always one or two metrics that were, let's call it North Star metrics. They were out of this world type mm-hmm. of metrics.
Okay.
It's not always the same. I don't like to advise people to look at the same metrics because those metrics change. In the old days, people used to look at day one retention. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then it became day seven. Then it became day seven over day one. Then people are looking at ROAS and people are looking at this. It just depends on the game. Usually there are signs that you look at, and we look at, you know, retention, we look at ROAS, we look at all of those things. But depending on the genre, depending on the time in the market, depending on a bunch of things, you will look at other metrics. But what was common among the games that made it was that there was one or two metrics that were just, we couldn't believe. It could have been, you know, time spent inside the app. It could have been the ARPDAU that we saw. It could have been the number of ads people were willing to watch or whatever it is. That actually made us continue to invest. And I think the biggest advantage that we have, so if you take two parallel universes and you take, you know, Akin A and Akin B, and Akin A is really in love with the games that he's making and so on, it's very hard to know objectively for Akin A when to double down or when to pivot that specific direction. Because if I'm building something new, there's really a lack of comparables in the market for me. So I will just basically go down this road and I will build, and I will kind of try to make it work. Whereas Akin B, if he's building from a, you know, starting point of my thesis is that there's a market for this game, then, you know, he doesn't necessarily give up when he sees some metrics that don't work. He, you know, so oftentimes, you know, some of the games that made it, like Mudoku, it took us a long time for that game to scale. And the reason we didn't give up or we didn't pivot into another game was we felt, looking at the data, looking at the market, that there was a space for this game in that market, whether it be the marketing creatives, whether it be the theme, whether it be whatever is less of the point, but we knew objectively that we could make that game work.
It's very interesting compared to that discussion about what are the North Star metrics. And what you're saying is basically they come and go, you know, it's ROAS, it's cost per, now it's LTV, right? LTV combined with ROAS. But what you are saying here that's interesting is that that's not as important as seeing two performance metrics that are just outstanding. And it's not a particular metric. It's the fact that they have reached a level that has gotten your attention and therefore has you thinking again about it. So it's not like a sign of commercial success. There is, do I see signs and should I continue?
I really don't want to be formulaic because if I come here and say, oh, we look at whatever day seven ROAS needs to be X and day seven retention needs to be Y percent. And, you know, like there's a very strong chance that will change within less than 6 months. And there's a very real chance that what I say is only true for a specific type of game that we are doing. So I have the luxury of, you know, operating in this space for many years. And what you see is really there's a huge difference between what works for type game, you know, certain type of games, and what you know, those things may not work for other type of games. Specifically, you know, in the early days, a lot of the advice that was given to game company entrepreneurs were focus on retention, focus on retention. And once you have retention, you know, now we are seeing that retention is, I mean, retention is as an objective metric and as a idea, it's very, very important, of course, but it depends a lot on other things such as the UA channel, such as many other market factors, etc. So you might have a game with insane retention, but just never makes it out of the market. We see examples of that all the time. So it's just really understanding, you know, the core kind of value proposition of what's going to make that game operate at scale. And it may be something that you're not, you know, used to.
So again, you know, this is why we were saying I can't offer you anything, you know, any kind of big takeaway. I think you have. I think you absolutely have, which is treat each of your games as individual titles. I tell a lot of indie developers, you know, your job is not just to make the next thing. Your job is, as Stephen King put it, to kill your darlings. It's like find the one that excites you, find the one that has that North Star, that kind of hook that you can work on. So from the other side, what does a commercial success look like today, and has that changed significantly since you've landed here in the world of games?
You know, commercial success also has quite a different definition depending on the personalities in the room. So the way, for example, you know, we define commercial success is any game that needs to be at least making $100,000 a day in net revenue and can support profitable UA. Profitable UA will mean different things depending on the type of game. But that's our definition of what is a successful game, for instance. Other cases, it might be that, you know, you are a two-person team. And I see a lot more of these nowadays, by the way. You are a two-, three-person team. And there are a lot of incredibly smart people who are able to generate $40, $50 million in revenue that are super profitable, $10, $15 million of profits, net profit every year just between the three of them. That is a very successful business. But if you kind of put on the lens of revenue growth and revenue, you know, world domination, you know, those companies are not generating a royal match or something like that. You know, so, but that might be okay because they are, that's the path they have chosen. I think Royal Match is clearly one of the most successful games ever in the history of mobile gaming, in my opinion. That's a universally accepted measure of success. But I guess my point is there are a lot more hidden measures of success depending on the personality, depending on the life, you know, choice that of the founders. The reason we started Triple Dot and the reason we define success as we do is we really feel that we have an opportunity to create a generational company. And that's kind of our belief. So our definition of success is that. I don't want to say it depends to all your questions, but this one really depends. Because if you're three brothers in, you know, if you're three people in France that are generating those kind of numbers, I think you are very successful by any measure. So, you know, again, it just depends on the personality.
Success at a Supercell level is a completely different, you know, level of demand and monetization and longevity than it is for, you know, the indie studio out there who want to be sustainable and, you know, potentially scalable. So I think, again, a point very well made.
And just to tie this into the earlier KPI discussion, I think the commonality that we see in those games that have been commercially successful is longevity. And whether you define it as day 90 retention, day 360 retention, whatever it is, or in the case of those games where I said, you know, lower day one retention, I think the shape of the curve is something that really gives away usually successful games. So if you have I guess the value should be in the tail for really, really successful games. And that's one of the reasons that its gaming sector is really misunderstood, because it's hard to intuitively understand the value of the tail, meaning the value of those people who are going to come into your game every day for many, 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 many years, and you know, become repeat customers of your game. That's really hard to understand from an intuitive perspective. So, you know, any kind of measure of success in my mind, like, you know, we talked about hyper-casual. Hyper-casual was a great way for a while to generate cash. It was probably not a great way to generate a lot of value, but that might be okay depending on what is your goal. If your goal was to create cash, and I know a lot of studios in Turkey and other places that use the hyper-casual train as a funding hack. Almost. They generated a lot of money, and they are now using that money to deploy other really high quality gaming experiences with much more longevity, much more tail, much more long-term retention. So it really all depends. And this is part of what makes gaming so exciting, is because these are very analytical constructs, analytical frameworks you can make decisions with.
Great framework, because we've always heard about, you know, like the long tail. Now we're looking at like a tail of value, and maybe not all of it only through maintaining the game, through live ops, whatever, but just maybe through mechanics as well, is what I'm hearing. You know, you don't have to maybe actively maintain it. Maybe it is just a matter of cultivating it.
You know, to be honest, I don't know how to do it without, you know, active management of the game. So we do a lot of live ops. We were probably one of the first pioneers of bringing really sophisticated live ops into in-app ad monetized games. But your point is also very valid, because, you know, the reason gaming is so beautiful, every time you make a statement like I just made, you know, you have to have live ops to, you know, keep tail value. There's a very legitimate counterexample. So it's very hard to create religions around certain things. So, you know, now that I've said that, I'm thinking, well, there's this company that did that, there's that company that. So there are a lot of examples of, you're right, actually, people that have created experiences, and those experiences are, they have long-lasting tail value in and of themselves. And probably if somebody that wanted to do more live ops took those experiences over, they could generate even more value. But, you know, even without that, those experiences last for a very long time. So yeah, it's very interesting.
I'd like to talk, however, about not just the games themselves, but the conditions, the market conditions. Talking about market conditions, you know, yours in Turkey is outstanding for a variety of reasons, but maybe you can distill it down to the unique opportunity, maybe one unique opportunity, one unique challenge that Turkey represents.
I'll start with a disclaimer. You know, I left Turkey when I was 16, and I go back a couple times every year. But other than the companies that I've invested in, you know, I haven't lived there for a long period of time. And actually observing from outside is really quite a unique experience. So I think it's quite interesting. I think we can now call Turkey one of the hubs, if not the hub of gaming, especially mobile gaming. You know, the reason why that emerged, I think there's a few different reasons, and it all those things combined, and they came together in a very unique period of time. And one of those was just the kind of underlying readiness of Turkish demographics. So Turkey is a very large country, but it's a very young country. I think I'm going to hand wavy recall some numbers, but I think it's about 80 million people. And I think 70% are under the age of 35. And this could even be even more tilted towards young people. They are very well, you know, educated, and really there's a big amount of talent in Turkey. I think any friend of mine that is not from Turkey, when they interact with Turkish people, they're very surprised for a few reasons. One is they're surprised at how hardworking Turkish people are. And it's always wrong to generalize positively or negatively, but I think there are certain things in gaming that actually are very true. Turkish people are quite hardworking, and there's a culture that actually demands it. Second is, there's a very interesting element in the gaming space, which is this requirement that, you iterate really, really fast, and you see something somewhere else and you take it and you adopt it to your own. You see something somewhere else and you take it, you adopt to your own. That actually fits very well with the culture. Like, in, Turkey, arguably, I'm not a historian, but you could say Turkey was the country that either invented or perfected the concept of bazaars, right? So like, you have this really commercial savviness that you see something and you say, okay, that might work, and you bring that on board. And then there's this level of really quick iteration that is important in understanding. And the other thing is kind of the necessity of it is, it's very hard to imagine another industry that requires very low capital. Like, you don't really require money to get started in gaming, right? Like, we can start a gaming company in Turkey very quickly. You make your money in US dollars, which is a huge plus for a country that is always in some sort of economic crisis. You can reach global audiences very, very quickly. So that's very attractive. So you put all those things together and you layer on top of it probably the most important thing, which is Turkey is a very Darwinian society. What I mean by that is, once there's an example in front of you, everybody's going to attack that market. So in 2011, this was e-commerce, in the early 2010, 2011, everybody wanted to start an e-commerce company in Turkey. And one of my best friends, Demet, started before that. Actually, she was probably the reason why all these people wanted to start e-commerce companies. Demet dropped out of Harvard, started a company called Trendyol. Now, Trendyol is is the Amazon of Turkey, and it's worth probably close to $20 billion. And there was an example what Demet created, and everybody wanted to chase that example. That same example in gaming is really Sidar and Peak Games. Sidar and Peak Games was the example that, this is possible. You can create a behemoth out of Turkey. And not only that, but a lot of people actually pass through the Peak Games school. So my view of the world is, mobile gaming especially is so young, and you have these universities around the world, not just in Turkey. In Turkey, that was probably Peak Games was the main one. But in, you have Playrix, you have Playtika, you have Supercell, you have countless examples of these universities, and people are graduating from those universities. They're getting trained how to make games, how to ship games, how to scale games. This happened in Turkey at a very unique moment, and we know the rest. So you have a young, hungry, talented workforce. They're not afraid to take risks, and it becomes it becomes quite an interesting moment. People also say initially the cost of labor helped, but right now I don't think it's a thing. I think cost of labor is no longer an advantage in Turkey.
I think Turkey deserves every respect and all the kudos we can give to it, because it really has come through as a shining star of the next generation of games.
A lot of it is really understanding that if you build a truly world-class product, I think it's going to become much easier for you to market it. But that's building that product is only half the challenge, right? It's just really a matter of being able to scale that, being able to really understand performance marketing. So I think maybe the better way to articulate what I previously said is that performance marketing as a science was really appreciated by Turkish people quite early on. And how to scale this using advertising and so on is something that was almost like a dirty word in the West, right? The adage in the West was, build a great product and they will come. Whereas Turkey was, you know, and not just Turkey, there are other ecosystems that are exceptional, like Israel, for example, at this as well, but that really appreciated, no, it's not enough. I need to put it in front of people. And that takes additional science, that takes additional skills. And, you know, I will really master those skills. And I think that was the kind of, you know, hidden, another hidden thing in the Turkish success story.
What advice would you give to embrace still the science of performance marketing, but also understand where we are right now? Because it's going to be a modification of what we could do before. Where are we, and what are those trends? What are those drivers we need to be aware of?
Really, the peak moment was for me when people said in 2014, where there's no other casual game can be made because Candy Crush was crowding the market and there was, you know, no other company can compete with Candy Crush. Then came Playrix, then came Peak Games, then came Dream Games. And this is all within a single subsegment of, you know, casual puzzle space. So that's a perfect counterexample. So, I mean, it's undeniable that with the IDFA changes, with, you know, Google Privacy Sandbox, with all those things that are happening, you know, performance marketing has its challenges. But that being said, right now, we are in a place where there are a lot of opportunities in performance marketing too. So again, just in terms of counterexamples, you know, there are so many games that are scaling exceptionally well right now because of performance marketing, and you know, they're doing something right. And you know, clearly, it's not black magic, or it's not, you know. So if I take a step back, I think the mobile gaming ecosystem was definitely reliant too much maybe on performance marketing. And I think you could argue that it's reached some unhealthy levels. We had a lot of, you know, academic level discussions about kind of, you know, these creatives not representing the actual gameplay, whether they should be used and so on and so forth. And then the Apple decision really impacted performance marketing dependent industries, not just gaming, but, you know, it was e-commerce and a lot of other industries to a large extent. And right now I say that, you know, I firmly believe nothing underlying about the consumer desires have changed. You know, privacy has made distribution, yes, more, the privacy demands, the privacy related changes made distribution more challenging. But to me, if you're an experienced team, that's even potentially better because you are going to win against people that were doing it maybe less smart than you or more brute force than you. And I mean, what better example than the continued success of Royal Match, right? Like, you build an amazing product, and are they not impacted by privacy IDFAs? Oh, of course they are, but they're continuing to scale, which means that I think the trick is finding that balance of product excellence and marketing know-how, because anything you build today is going to be copied within a couple of weeks anyway. That's just what makes mobile gaming challenging but also interesting, because anybody can build that and take what you've built and iterate on it, etc. So the way to differentiate still lies in understanding your funnel, understanding why you're building what you're building, and understanding really distribution. I think a lot of people have argued IP is going to become more important. A lot of people have argued that, you know, alternative stores are going to be more important. You know, those things might be tools, but I really doubt there'll be a silver lining, because it's such a competitive red ocean industry that if something works, it's going to be, people are going to attack that. And so I really think that for every time someone says, oh, you know, IDFA did XYZ to our business, there's a counterexample. So I don't think anything fundamentally will change. People are going to have mobile phones and people are going to play mobile games for sure. So it's just a matter of understanding distribution, understanding product to an extent where, like, details are the product. So, you know, that's the most important thing. Details are the product, both within the core product you're building, but also the amount of attention you pay to details and distribution and monetization is really what will set you apart in against competition as well.
It's one of those areas where we keep hearing from developers, but everything's changing. And if the one constant you have is change, being agile enough to adapt to it and innovate in it, and being resilient enough to cope and, you know, deal with any of the sort of the challenges that brings, then it leaves the market wide open. You know, far from a static marketplace where everything has been the same for the last decade, it's so refreshing to hear from somebody who's going, yeah, we know change is coming, deal with it.
Yeah, and actually, that's a very good point, because another thing I think that really, it sounds like motherhood and apple pie, but it's so true, is it's all really in the quality of the people that you bring to your team. And one thing we tried to do very early on, and this is something that everyone says they do, but it's really hard to do as an operator. So, which is, we try to have people that are really experienced domain experts. So like, I think we have one of the best marketing teams, for example, and also best product teams. And we have really experienced leaders there. But underneath, we try almost not to hire too many experienced people. We try to instead hire really smart, really hungry, but super young people. And actually, you know, they are kind of educated within our school of thought, if you will. And that's, everybody pays lip service to that, but it's very hard to actually do, because it's very easy to, you know, when you start a company, it's very easy to say, I'm going to hire this person. They've done this at X company for so many years. It's just easier, and probably it sounds less risky. But what you said about adaptability and the comfort with ambiguity is so important, so critical, that it's just much better for a person that is just smart, hungry, but doesn't have to unlearn a bunch of stuff to learn new stuff.
Sadly, folks, that's all the time we have for this episode. Akin, I think you're right. We could go on for a long, long time. We have barely scratched the surface. So all we can do is ask if you'll accept an invitation to come back at some point in the future and talk to us again.
Anytime, of course. My yes. Pleasure.
Yay.
So the question that everyone gets asked when they come on the show, Akin, is, what are you playing right now that is currently obsessing you and you're spending time with? And secondly, what's your favorite game of all time?
In my case, it might be the same answer, because as I mentioned earlier, during COVID, I started going down this rabbit hole of chess, to a point where actually my wife had to sit me down and said, we have to talk about your chess addiction. It's better now, but I'm not quite over it yet. So I play probably an hour, probably more, of chess per day, and it's been absolutely amazing to, you know, rediscover a game that's been around since, I guess, I don't know, 500, 600 years. That's what I'm playing. I'm also playing quite a lot of Royal Match, and of course I'm playing a lot of Wudoku and Triple Tile and some of our games.
A great answer. I knew it was going to be interesting, and it absolutely was. So thank you, Akin.
Allow me also to thank you, Akin. It has been a delight. It has been a joy.
Same here. Thank you so much for having me.
An absolute delight. And again, thank you. And we'll have you back anytime. And until then, folks, that brings us to the end.
Indeed. This show is all about how to do your job better, how to make an amazing game, how to market it. And you have a say. So if you have a story or know someone we need to shine a light on, then we would love to hear from you.
We want to hear from you. We want to reflect the reality of the mobile games market in all its wonderful complexity and strangeness. So if you have any suggestions for us, or you have any feedback for us, you can always get in touch. You can email us at podcast@pocketgamer.biz. You can find us on Twitter at PGBiz, and you can reach out to us through the pocketgamer.biz website. If you're interested in listening to all of our podcasts, you can find them at pocketgamer.biz/podcast. and we would love to hear your thoughts on future shows.
And we've got you covered on all the major platforms, so subscribe to the audio podcast, as Brian said. Look for us on YouTube. If you want to read it, hey, you can do that too, because we have a companion post for you as well on the pocketgamer.biz website.
Tune in again for the next edition of the pocketgamer.biz podcast, and we look forward to speaking to you in the near future.